All right. Hi, everybody, and thanks very much for inviting me to come talk to you today. As mentioned, I'll be speaking about some of the research that my group members and I have been doing on red supergiants. The tagline here is stolen from the Kippenhahn and Weigert textbook that was describing modeling stellar evolution and highlighted red supergiants and other evolved massive stars as magnifying glasses. As they describe it, if you're trying to model stellar evolution and you get something wrong, these are the faces that are very unforgiving. When you compare reality to when you compare observations to theory, they will, I think their quote is, ruthlessly reveal the faults of earlier calculations. So this is a big reason behind why we're studying red supergiants. We're using them as tests of how we understand how stars work and as benchmarks in their own right for understanding stellar evolution, stellar death, and compact objects. So this is my research group at UW. This is sort of everybody. I'm counting a few folks who have just moved on or who will soon be moving on. Jamie Lomax was a postdoc working with me, and she's now faculty at the US Naval Academy. Locke Patton was working with me, and he's now in grad school at Harvard. And Aishlin Wallach has been working with me, and they're about to start grad school at BU. So just to start off, I figured it would be good to remind everybody what red supergiants are. So we can start out with the basic HR diagram, plotting temperature on the x-axis and luminosity on the y-axis, and we can then drop most normal-looking stars onto the diagram. We can highlight sort of the main regions of stellar classifications that we know. We can identify main sequence stars, our lower mass giants, and then the supergiants stretching right across the top of the HR diagram. So the stars I'm interested in are the very coldest and largest members of this population and stars descended from massive main sequence stars. The way that this will go is that you'll start out with a star on the main sequence that is going along happily enjoying its main sequence life and fusing hydrogen until one day it runs out. It then switches from fusing hydrogen to fusing helium, and along the way, it will start to expand and cool off according to this basic principle of luminosity going as radius squared times temperature to the fourth. Its temperature will drop, its radius will go up as its luminosity stays about the same thanks to hydrogen shell burning. It'll take a brief pit stop as a yellow supergiant but pass across the HR diagram very quickly and eventually wind up as a red supergiant fusing helium in its core. So these are the coldest and physically largest massive stars that we know of. They're very distinct from red giants, despite them being really unfortunately named. They have much higher initial masses, they have shorter lifetimes, and they follow a completely different evolutionary pathway in terms of what they fuse and how fast they fuse it. They're also either an end phase or an intermediate phase in massive star evolution. So some stars will just straight up die here as red supergiants. In other cases, a binary companion or strong winds will start stripping off those outer layers, and the star will get bluer and bluer and scoot back somewhere off to the side of the screen and become a Wolf-Rayet star before dying. We can trace the evolution of these stars over the course of their lives like this, and with the full suite of these, we can move to a fully theoretical HR diagram modeling the evolution of massive stars. So these are evolutionary tracks for stars with initial masses of 12 solar masses shown on the bottom in black, all the way up to 40 solar masses shown in red. And you can see where the red supergiants land. They fall in this very narrow and fairly uniform temperature regime way over on the coolest side of the HR diagram. This is showing us a lot about what they're up to on their exteriors, and that'll be primarily what I'm focusing on today, but I do want to briefly touch on what's going on in the interiors of these stars. So this is a Kippenhahn diagram for a 15 solar mass star. On the main sequence, you can see that it's just happily fusing hydrogen to helium in the core. And you can then see the very quick shift to helium fusion in the core and a little shell of hydrogen fusion outside it, along with this big, puffy convective envelope that characterizes it as a red supergiant. The size of that envelope and the fact that it's so cold means that if you actually combine what the interior of the star is doing with the exterior and consider the surface of a red supergiant, it's doing this. The scale height is extremely large, so you wind up with these big convection cells with radii that are on the order of the radii of the star. So it just looks like this big bubbling mess of a star from the outside, and this can make life pretty confusing when we try to do things like model or interpret photometry of these, which I'll get to in a little bit. So red supergiants are fun, they're big, they're cold, they look weird. But why do we actually care? Why would somebody care about red supergiants and how they evolve and what they do? So the argument I would make is that you care. Everybody in the room cares about red supergiants in some degree if you work on any of the many, many things listed on the screen. They have a massive impact on how stars evolve and die. They contribute to enrichment from massive stars. Many red supergiants are strange and variable stars that we'll identify. They're supernova progenitors, compact object progenitors, gravitational wave progenitors. And I'll get to some of these in more detail today. But just as a reminder, everybody cares about red supergiants. They're fascinating. And we want to try and understand their physical properties and how to study them as well as possible. There's a few challenges that we bump into along the way right off the bat when we move from red supergiants are cool to red supergiants are things that we want to study. And the first is literally how cool they are. We want to get a good understanding of red supergiant temperatures. We know that red supergiants should, in theory, land in this narrow strip of the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram known as the Hayashi limit. The problem for a very long time is that as we were observing red supergiants and trying to infer temperatures from the data, they were landing not over there, but over here, in this sort of forbidden region to the right of the evolutionary tracks. In this part of the HR diagram, stars should not be able to maintain hydrostatic equilibrium, but if you plotted red supergiants on this diagram in 2003, most of them landed in the forbidden stars don't work here regime. And our immediate reaction was, well, obviously the theorists are doing everything wrong, and they've completely screwed up how they do the evolutionary tracks. The tracks simply must just need to go a little bit colder because the observations say the stars are this temperature and the observations are never wrong. And the problem came with how we were interpreting observations. For a very long time, we didn't have a good temperature scale for red supergiants, and we had no good way of translating a color or a spectrum into a temperature. This changed when the MARCS stellar evolutionary models came out, which were the first really high-quality models of stellar atmosphere spectra for red supergiants. And these show you that we actually have some wonderful thermometers available to us in red supergiant spectra. The spectrum I'm showing right now is a red supergiant optical spectrum with a temperature of about 4,000 Kelvin. We would have classified this as a K1 type star. As you cool the models off, you can see what happens to the spectrum. You see these big bites start appearing in the spectrum. These are the absorption bands of titanium oxide, which rapidly appear and then get stronger and stronger as the star gets colder. You're able to have more molecules hanging out in the atmosphere, the bands get stronger, the corresponding temperature gets cooler, and we have a wonderful tool for mapping spectral type and the spectral appearance to temperature. When we originally applied this to a sample of 75 Milky Way red supergiants, the stars moved from here to here. They went from terrible agreement with the tracks to wonderful agreement with the tracks, so the theorists had done a delightful job. And as soon as we got the observations in order, we had nice agreement. So red supergiant temperatures are solved, except not. This breaks down in low metallicity galaxies. When we do that same fix, we no longer get the nice, neat, perfect agreement with the evolutionary tracks. This technique's also limited to the optical. If you try to measure temperatures based on SED fits or infrared data, the results don't quite match. The temperatures that we get are a little bit off. And trying to get these fluxed optical spectra are observationally really costly. It's hard to go get multiple spectra that are nicely flux calibrated and cover a wide enough spectral range that we can get multiple titanium oxide bands and fit atmosphere models. So one thing my group and I are starting to look at are other ways to measure temperatures. The plot on the left is from a paper that an undergraduate at UW, Brooke DeCenzo, who actually started working with me when they were in high school. This is a plot from their paper showing effective temperature versus the sum of the calcium triplet lines in several different samples. So the black data points are actually observed spectra from Milky Way red supergiants. The colored lines are calcium to some equivalent widths from the MARCS models in different ranges. So you can see that the calcium 2 line is a bit degenerate between both effective temperature and surface gravity, but as a collective set, it serves as a decent gauge of effective temperature. The complication with surface gravity is the problem, so to use this well, we really also need a gauge of surface gravity independent of temperature. And we actually have one in the form of H alpha. there are little tiny H-alpha absorption lines in red supergiant spectra. They're buried in the titanium oxide mess. But these lines actually get wider as we go from dwarfs to supergiants. It sounds counterintuitive. Surface gravity should work the other way. Whereas the atmosphere gets denser, the lines get broader due to more collisional broadening. The detail comes from where this broadening effect happens. This actually isn't a direct collisional broadening effect. This is a consequence of non-LTE effects in red supergiant atmospheres. You'll get an overpopulation of one of the metastable states in H-alpha. That means you actually get more transitions in a low-density environment, and you wind up with these broader H-alpha lines. So combining these right now, we can still do an okay job of estimating temperature from red supergiants, even for small samples. You still need fairly high-resolution spectra to get something like these differences in H-alpha, and you still need spectra to look at calcium-2. There's some good news in that Gaia's spectra actually do cover the calcium-2 triplet. We haven't gotten the chance to test this on their data yet, obviously, because the spectra aren't out. But once we do, this could be an alternative tool for measuring temperatures for a big sample of red supergiants. Photometry is also one possibility. It turns out that V minus K colors of these stars do an okay job of estimating temperature, and I'll talk a little more about photometric diagnostics for these near the end of my talk. So another challenge that we run into when we study red supergiants is how to identify samples in other galaxies. This is one of the things that makes red supergiants really appealing. They're so luminous that we can easily study extragalactic populations in and even slightly beyond the local group. But in order to do this, we need to be able to identify red supergiants in other galaxies. So where do we start? You want things that are red, and you want things that are supergiant, so luminous. So we need to start by defining red. Red is obviously coming from the temperatures of these stars, and the stars' temperatures are dependent on the environments that they're in. I pointed out the Hayashi limit before, sort of this rightmost reach of the evolutionary tracks that dictates how cold a red supergiant is allowed to get. That limit actually shifts to warmer temperatures at lower metallicities. The evolutionary tracks here are shown for Milky Way metallicities in black, for LMC metallicities in red, and for SMC metallicities in blue. And you can see that track shifting warmer and warmer as metallicity drops. This comes from what the Hayashi limit actually is. What we're seeing is an observational consequence of an opacity effect. You have more free electrons at higher metallicity. This gives you a higher abundance of ionized hydrogen, which is the main opacity source in these stars' atmospheres. So at high metallicity, the H-minus opacity is increasing. It gives us a shallower optical depth, and it gives us what appears to be a cooler temperature for these stars. We have seen this theoretically. We also see it observationally. As we go from Milky Way metallicity red supergiants to red supergiants in a galaxy like WLM, which is 1/10 the metallicity of the Milky Way, the average spectral type, so the average temperature of red supergiants, moves way earlier. We also see this if we compare red supergiants in M33 to evolutionary tracks of M33 at different radii in the galaxy. M33 has a known metallicity gradient. So as we move closer to the center of M33, where the metallicity is higher, you can watch these points move from left of the evolutionary tracks to right of the evolutionary tracks, and then even slightly beyond them. This is purely a metallicity effect on the temperatures that these stars were allowed to have. So overall, we get a warmer average temperature, and this means a bluer average color for red supergiant populations at low metallicities. So if you wanted to select, based on color, some red supergiants to study in another galaxy, you can't use the same colors that we have in the Milky Way. You have to be able to accommodate for metallicity effects. So we've now confused what red means. Next up, we can confuse what supergiant or luminosity means. We need to pick a range of luminosities to sample if we want to grab a red supergiant population in another galaxy. And it looks easy at first when you look at the full-on HR diagram. Everybody's shorthand is that stars magically, and with no ambiguity at all, become massive stars at 8 solar masses. So you can draw a line at 8 solar masses, grab everything above it, and you're fine. You've gotten all of the red supergiants and some lower mass stars. The problem with this method is that you can get pretty significant contamination from the lower mass giants or AGB stars. These just thanks to the mighty fist of the IMF, are very numerous, so you wind up having a contaminating population that can sometimes dominate what you would hope to be a clean, massive star population. We have done an absolutely terrible job of trying to compromise on how best to do this. So this is a plot dropping a sample of presumed Milky Way red supergiants onto an HR diagram. These are the Geneva evolutionary tracks in color. And you could maybe just grab all of them, but you're now going to get some stars that would be lower mass and would be traditionally not considered massive stars. These are contaminating AGB or super AGB stars. You could put in a really conservative cut, but you're now losing some of the lower mass bona fide red supergiants that, again, are going to be the most numerous. So we wind up with a compromise that pleases absolutely nobody, because we still lose some of the lowest mass red supergiants and capture some super AGB stars. So if we want to grab a population of red supergiants in another galaxy, the temperatures we select and the luminosities we select are both crucially important, and trying to draw those lines properly is dependent on observations that we're still refining. The luminosities also get messier when you consider other issues. The distance accuracy to a red supergiant can dramatically affect what luminosity you infer. Metallicity on its own can also potentially affect what luminosity you're measuring, especially depending on what band you're extrapolating luminosity from. Circumstellar dust can cause a huge problem. The figure on the right is VY Canis Majoris, which is a Milky Way red supergiant with this enormous, very complex dusty envelope surrounding it. Red supergiant dust can be larger grain than typical dust. It can act gray rather than preferentially grabbing blue light. So how dust impacts the luminosity you infer can get complicated very quickly. And we know that these stars are photometrically variable. You saw the boiling red supergiant that I showed before. And we know that even normal red supergiants can vary by up to a magnitude in the V band. So without controlling for these, it makes it even harder to identify a full and complete sample of red supergiants in another galaxy. The last challenge, and the one that my research group has recently been doing the most work on, are red supergiants in binaries. I would argue that red supergiants are the most crucial evolutionary phase if you're trying to determine the fate of moderately massive stars in binaries. Any star that goes through a red supergiant phase is going to find itself in its most important phase when it is also at its physically largest, and you can easily see why. A massive binary could be too wide for interactions to impact stellar evolution. You could have two stars in a binary happily living their lives, waving to their neighbors occasionally, but never having any actual direct impact on the star's evolution, until one star becomes a red supergiant. Red supergiants have the largest radii of massive stars. So when you hit the red supergiant phase, you have also hit the point where it is easiest to undergo Roche-Loeb overflow. At this point, interaction kicks off. The primary starts losing mass, the secondary starts gaining mass, the orbit circularizes now that we have mass exchange going on, and you've turned this from a non-interacting into an interacting binary. This can get worse when you consider red supergiants that can merge with close companions. It'll impact the terminal evolution and potentially even decrease the population that you'll get of binary compact objects if this merger happens sufficiently before one or both of the stars die. So we know that binary evolution is going to dramatically impact red supergiants, and you can see the illustration of it here. This is another theoretical HR diagram with the BPAS stellar evolution models from J.J. Eldridge's group overplotted. So right now, this is just showing single star evolution, which doesn't look that dramatically different than what we've seen so far. You can compare the evolution of single stars to the evolution of stars that are in binaries. So right now, we're tracking what the primary in the binary is doing. We have a secondary to primary mass ratio of 20%, and we're modeling fairly medium periods here of 100 days. But you can see what happens. These stars will start interacting after they've left the main sequence and started to expand. You'll see mass peeled off of these stars. You see many more of them evolving back to the blue side of the HR diagram. They start dying not as red supergiants, but as Roche-Loeb overflow-stripped Wolf-Rayet stars. And the overall population of stars is going to have dramatically changed. It gets even worse if you go from a sort of typical binary with that 100-day period to close binaries. So this is the same sample, but now we have 10-day periods instead of 100-day periods. So again, 100-day periods, 10-day periods. You can see that the mass stripping starts earlier, that it's much more dramatic, and that it has a much more substantial effect on the luminosity of the star, how it passes through its interim evolution, and again, what it looks like when it dies. So all of this is hopefully demonstrating to you how important binary evolution is and how much this starts mattering, specifically at the red supergiant phase and at every point once these stars leave the main sequence. So this is a major project for one of my graduate students. This is Trevor Dorn Wallenstein. He's just about to start his fifth year at UW. And what he's looking at are the evolutionary effects of binary evolution in populations of massive stars. So the plot shown here shows the evolution of a stellar population. The entire population was a million solar masses when he modeled it, as a function of time. On the y-axis are the number of red supergiants, shown in red, and the number of Wolf-Rayet stars, shown in purple, as a function of time. The dashed lines are entirely single populations, and the solid lines are entirely binary populations. And you can see what binary evolution does to the relative number of red supergiants and Wolf-Rayet stars. We get way fewer red supergiants if the binary fraction is 100%. You get way more of the older Roche-Loeb overflow-stripped Wolf-Rayet stars showing up at surprisingly late times. So just by turning on binarity when we model a stellar population, you wind up making a stellar population that's very different. We've actually tried to take this to the next step. We've stolen some plot designs from the galaxy environments and BPT diagram folks. So what we're showing here is the Wolf-Rayet to red supergiant ratio for a model on the x-axis, and the O star to blue supergiant ratio on the x-axis. We've made these for a bunch of different stellar ratios. We chose this one to show because it's the prettiest. Some of them just wind up looking like tangled balls of yarn. But what we're looking at here is how the ratio changes for each of the models at each of the intersecting points in this grid. So we go from a binary fraction of 0 in blue to a binary fraction of 100 in yellow, and we evolve from very late ages, in this case, to very early ages over here.
Did you keep the overall period distribution the same?
For these, we kept the overall period distribution the same. We wanted to just take the most typical type of binary that you could get. With the BPASS models, you can change the period, and you can change the mass ratio.
So what period distribution?
This was 100 days. So these were the more typical binary evolution tracks that I showed earlier.
Yeah, I guess what I'm asking is, there's an orbital period distribution. So I'm asking about what's the assumption of the orbital period distribution?
You'd have to check his paper for that, because I don't remember it off the top of my head. But we did leave it the same. We weren't trying different period distributions or different mass ratios. We wanted to minimize the number of knobs we were turning in the first pass. So what you can see with this is that the ratios are going to trace binarity and metallicity and age, et cetera. So you could imagine grabbing a complete massive star population and plotting it on here to see if you can learn anything about its binary fraction. So we did this with Westerland 1 and a massive star population from the Westerland 1 cluster. And at a glance, it looks really nice. It lands right about in the age range people have estimated for Westerland 1, and it sits happily on this all massive stars are always in binaries line that everybody would like it to be on. This is the catch with this sort of technique. The models are idealized. The models are counting every red supergiant, every O star, every Wolf-Rayet star born in this stellar population, and observations are never that good. You have to account for the completeness of the sample. The nice thing is that since we've built this fictional stellar population, we can bake completeness right into the models. This is what the plot looks like when we assume completeness and assume that you've observed every type of every massive star. We can simulate a model that shows the completeness that actually matches that data point. And life gets a lot worse. If you assume that we're only getting some of the red supergiants, we're only getting the red supergiants above a certain luminosity, that you're only getting Wolf-Rayet stars within a luminosity and temperature range and everything else, the diagnostic ability of this breaks down, but we are still able to match the models to the data point. So the interesting thing here is that if we can improve the completeness of our observations, we can sort of slowly expand that back to the nice separated grid that we originally saw, and potentially use observations of entire stellar populations to try and get a bead on what the binary fraction would be in that population. So we know that binary evolution dramatically impacts mass of stars. We know it specifically impacts how red supergiants lose mass and evolve and die, how they go through this Roche-Loeb overflow phase. But we know almost nothing about binary red supergiants in particular. A couple of years ago, when I was writing my red supergiant book, I got to the binary red supergiants chapter and went, oh great, I'm going to go find the review paper somebody's surely done listing off all of the binary red supergiants everywhere. There must be a bunch of them. This will be great. I'll just go off other people's research. And there was nothing. After a lot of hunting, I was able to work out that we had found about a dozen red supergiants with known and well-studied binary companions, and that they pretty broadly fell into one of two subtypes. One of these was the VV Cepheae subtype of red supergiant binary. So these are M-type red supergiants with little B-star companions orbiting in these very wide, very elliptical orbits. In VV Cepheae's case, it happens to be eclipsing. There's other members of the class that aren't eclipsing. And that B-star is actually a good distance away from the red supergiant. So this system is not and hasn't interacted, you can tell from the ellipticity of the orbit. What we are seeing is the B-star being eclipsed in front of and behind the red supergiant and passing through the wind, so we can get some great observations of red supergiant winds, and we know the B-star is accreting some material that the red supergiant has already lost. But it's an interesting extreme example of just how far away these companions are when you can still detect them and pick up a clear red supergiant binary. The other subclass are the Zeta Or binaries. I've put it here just for scale comparison, so that's Zeta Aurigae. I can blow it up to make it a little easier to look at. It is essentially exactly the same thing, except these are K-type red supergiants rather than M-type red supergiants, so everything about the whole situation is smaller. But you still have a K-star and a B-star orbiting. I think all of these stars happen to be in eclipsing binaries, and the B-star is orbiting at a great distance, so there's no direct interaction. It's passing through the wind of the red supergiant. Yeah? I think these were discovered through the eclipses, is my understanding. I don't know what they have for astrometry on them, but I know that VV Cepheae, for example, is discovered through the spectroscopic signature in the eclipses and has been incredibly well studied. Okay. Yeah. So we want more than 12 of these in theory. We'd like to try and quantify the red supergiant binary population, and we'd like to understand the evolution of these systems, but the first step is figuring out how to actually find and identify red supergiants and binaries. The traditional way that we find binaries is through light curves. You look for periodic variations in a light curve that are signs of one star going around another. But remember this. This is what a red supergiant actually looks like when life is normal. We have so many things contributing to photometric variability in these stars that we cannot find any reliable signature of binary evolution around red supergiants. We've seen red supergiants with known binary companions that cannot be discerned whatsoever based on their light curves. So we need some other trick. This is what my other graduate student at UW, Catherine Nugent, has been working on with me. She's getting ready to go into her third year. And she is looking at how we can identify red supergiant binaries and then what we can do to refine what we understand about the red supergiant binary fraction and how these stars evolve. If you look at the spectrum of a typical red supergiant, you might think that this example right here just looks like a normal red supergiant. If you zoom in on the blue side of that spectrum, though, you see an interesting extra signature. These are higher order Balmer lines produced by a B-star companion. I'd mentioned those 12 systems that we'd known about before, these red supergiants with wide B-star companions. When Catherine started this, she took stellar evolutionary tracks and effectively hit play to figure out, during the red supergiant lifetime, what stars could possibly also exist as binary companions. For the vast majority of red supergiants, which will have lower mass companions thanks to the IMF, they will have B-star companions. Once in a while, one star might have an O-star companion or a fellow red supergiant as a companion, but the vast majority of the population will be B-stars. By the time you get to A-stars or later, these stars will still be forming by the time the red supergiants have died or left their red supergiant phase. So she was able to go through and model what red supergiants with B-star companions would look like. So this was mashing up some red supergiant and B-star atmosphere models, and you can see the different permutations, really cold red supergiant and a pretty hot B dwarf, a very warm red supergiant and a pretty cool B giant. She basically mashed together every possible combination of models that you could, taking a B-star population, dwarf giant and supergiant, and a red supergiant population, added in factors of reddening around these systems, and came up with this. So this is a color-color plot of U minus B versus R minus I. Single blue stars land here, single red supergiants land here, and the combined models occupy the sort of duck face-shaped black region in the middle. What we were able to do was then translate this into a comparison with actual observations and identify a regime where red supergiants with those higher order Balmer lines from B stars should sit. They should basically be a little bit yellower than normal red supergiants because of what the B star is contributing to the spectrum. So we had figured out a way to photometrically identify candidates for red supergiant B star binaries. This was the first paper in what's going to eventually be her thesis. For her second paper, she went out and got spectroscopy of a bunch of her candidates. This included stars in the Magellanic Clouds, in M31, and in M33. And what we were able to do was determine that a majority of what we had identified were actual red supergiant B star binaries. You can see a few examples of them here. So again, this is a really cold red supergiant and a pretty warm B star, a red supergiant where the B star is actually dominating the shape of the SED, and again, these are the higher order Balmer lines, and then a star where if we had not looked closely at the Balmer lines, we would never have guessed that this actually had a binary companion from the spectrum alone. We had some false positives in there. We found a bunch of quasars behind M31 by accident and actually published a paper on quasars behind M31, which confused all of us because we'd never worked on quasars before in our lives. But it proved a really reliable way of identifying red supergiants with binary companions. Just based off of this work, we've quintupled the number of known red supergiant binaries, and we now have about 100 when before we had around 12. We haven't yet moved all the way to a red supergiant binary fraction, because the controlling factor in this, again, is completeness. We want to understand how many stars are definitively single, or at least definitively have a companion that is so small or so warm that we can't see it. Based on the method that Catherine's developed, we do identify pretty much all B stars that would be around most of these red supergiants. And we'd then like to move on to the next step, because
For the red supergiants in M31 and M33, were they already spectroscopically typed in NASA's catalog?
No, not all of them. Some of them were only photometrically identified, and this was the first time we'd gotten spectra. In other cases, we did have spectra, but nobody gets a red supergiant spectrum at like 3,800 angstroms, so we went back and just looked down there.
Okay.
Yeah. A big question here is that we've now found red supergiants with binary companions, but we can't say anything yet about whether they're interacting. These could be very wide B stars that aren't doing anything to the red supergiant, or we could already have mass exchange going on, and we're trying to figure out the best way to diagnose that. We'd also really like to see if there's any sign somewhere in the boiling mess of red supergiants in their variability that would indicate binarity. And we'd like to look for signs that some of these red supergiants that appear single could be post-merger rather than truly single stars. It's possible that some of these stars have already swallowed a close companion and are already feeling the effects of binary evolution. So I showed this earlier, this list of who cares about red supergiants, and my argument that everybody in the room must. So I'm going to back this up in a few key places and look at some applications of red supergiants to fields that are exciting right now. The first is gravitational waves. This tends to read like that line that you put on the first page of the grant proposal just to get everybody listening, but it really is true. Colliding neutron stars have evolved from red supergiants and binary systems. At least one, if not both, of those stars have passed through a phase as a red supergiant based on what we currently understand about initial masses and how we produce a neutron star remnant. So understanding how these stars lose mass, how binary evolution works, how many of these stars may be interacting or merging versus staying in wide elliptical binaries. All of this winds up having a really key impact on how many gravitational wave progenitor systems we expect for neutron star binaries. Supernova progenitors also run into the importance of red supergiants and understanding how they evolve. These are the events we know that directly produce some supernovae. The image on the left is a pre-supernova image of supernova 2008 BK, and if you watch it, you see the red star in the middle of the image disappear, when we go to the post-supernova image. So we know that red supergiants directly make what we call type 2P supernovae. So just as a reminder, this is what the light curve of a type 2P supernova looks like. The name comes from that plateau. We see a several dozen day flat plateau in the supernova brightness. What we think this is an interaction between the supernova's shockwave and the really thick envelope of the red supergiant that's been left behind. The shockwave will actually ionize the hydrogen in that outer envelope, and it basically gives us this temporary constant radius photosphere that makes the brightness look sustained for a short period of time. I want to jump off of this for just 1 second to plug another project that my research group is doing on transients and on supernovae, but in a slightly quirky direction. We're working on developing something called Transient Zoo, which is a citizen science project that helps people to classify light curves. The key here is that we're trying to build something that can be used by the visually impaired. So we've written a code that translates changes in brightness into changes in pitch. So this light curve, which happens to be a type 1A light curve, but it was the best plateau we had, will actually sound, let me see if we can hear it, it'll sound like this. So you can hear that temporary flatten off in the pitch as it starts to drop and then plateaus and then keeps going. It sounds very different than something like a type 2L light curve or a type 1C light curve that just goes straight down. We're working on trying to develop a blind-friendly mobile platform that'll let people tell the difference between a plateau or non-plateau light curve. iPhones are actually very accessible platforms, and there's no way to describe this that does not sound like Tinder for supernovae, but you can do it a la swipe left if you hear a plateau, swipe right if you don't hear one, swipe up if something sounds strange. We're designing this to eventually be used with data from the Zwicky Transient Facility and eventually from LSST, and we're working on trying to expand it to actually listen to variable star light curves as well. So Locke Patton is the student who's been working on this. He won a Chambliss Award at AAS for his poster, and he had a bunch of QR codes that you could go scan to listen to different supernovae, to eclipsing binaries, to Cepheids, which sound wacky, they sound like something out of science fiction. So we're hoping to keep this going as a way of classifying the plethora of light curves like this that will be coming in the coming years. But we still have to tie all of them back to where the progenitor stars came from. So we know that red supergiants are the progenitors of these events, and they're actually the stars that we have overwhelmingly had the most success with detecting in pre-supernova imaging. So you will see results identifying pre-explosion red supergiants that then try to infer physical properties for these stars. And I've talked a bit before and want to remind you again of how messy this can get. So the gray data points on the right here are observations of red supergiants that we've since seen die as supernovae. And note the error bars, which frankly are impressively small, considering that a lot of times we're just going off of a single photometric point. If we're lucky, we get two photometric points and we can actually get a color. So these are already beautifully narrowed observations, but you need to now then try to infer mass off of these based on these evolutionary tracks. So the solid lines here are single star evolutionary tracks. The dashed ones are stars that are now modeled with rotation, which we're still refining. And the dotted lines are binary evolutions. So if you take one of these gray dots and look at the error bars and then try to guess a mass, it's maybe somewhere between 12 and 20-ish. So the error bars that we put on these need to be very cautious when we recognize how little we still know about where exactly red supergiants land on the HR diagram and how they map back to our different models of stellar evolution. We also know that some stars will actually die here, but according to the models and according to our observations of stripped envelope supernovae, some of these red supergiants are going to leave before they die. They'll be evolved back over to the left side of the HR diagram and dying as Wolf-Rayet stars, which is a supernova progenitor sample that we're still working at constraining observationally. So finally, we know that red supergiants can look fairly strange and fairly variable. I've shown you the boiling surface and the photometric variability that we'll see. We also know that some of these stars will very dramatically vary in their spectra. These are four observations of the same red supergiant in the Small Magellanic Cloud, and you can see what its spectrum looked like in 2004, 2005, 2010, 2013. We checked, definitely the same star. but its temperature has changed from 4,300 Kelvin to 3,500 Kelvin to 3,800 Kelvin to about 3,650. It appears to be bouncing around dramatically. We're pretty sure that what's happening in this case is a mass loss and photospheric effect, but it still highlights that even the very color and shape of the star is changing as a consequence of something that's not well understood. So we know that there are mechanisms for variability in red supergiants, like that large-scale surface convection. We know that these stars can radially pulsate. We see evidence in their circumstellar environments of sporadic puffs of mass loss. Their circumstellar dust can change as a function of time as it starts to condense and cool. We see hydrostatic instabilities in some of these stars. When this star is in its coolest state, it is way into that forbidden region to the right of the Hayashi limit. We know that binary companions can cause problems, and we don't even know what else could possibly be contributing to these stars' variability. So a fun new place to work here is with data coming out of TESS. Trevor Dorn Wallenstein wrote a paper earlier this year. It actually just got accepted, so it's on AstroPH now, looking at variability of the small handful of massive stars that we were able to pull out of Sector 1 data in TESS. We got no red supergiants out of that sample, but we did get a handful of yellow supergiants. And you can see a difference between these two yellow supergiants, and we had a few more that all looked very similar, and whatever the heck this yellow supergiant is doing. This is a two-minute cadence, and we see notable differences in variability. And we're wondering if this can be mapped to a yellow supergiant that's moving right on the HR diagram to become a red supergiant, versus a yellow supergiant that's moving left on the HR diagram, post-red supergiant, to become something like a Wolf-Rayet star. We've proposed for more time on TESS. We're looking at getting a full sample of evolved massive stars in cycle 2, so this would include red supergiants and Wolf-Rayet stars. There's a couple LBVs in there. If you want to see what S-DOR looks like on a two-minute cadence, it's in this paper. So we're hoping that we'll have a lot more to say about this just by virtue of finally having a large data set to work with. And then finally, we can look at what's coming next for red supergiants. And we have upcoming space telescopes that are going to be focused on IR observations. We have James Webb, which is definitely launching in 2021, definitely. And we have WFIRST, which is definitely going to keep existing. But both of these are really good tools for studying red supergiants. They're good for looking at either local or extragalactic red supergiant populations. WFIRST will be amazing at getting big wide-field observations that can pre-image supernova progenitors. They're good for fixing some of our large error bars on pre-explosion imaging just by getting multiple colors and really being able to identify individual red supergiants in crowded fields. And we'll be able to get at red supergiant mass loss and dust production. The difficulty here is that all of this work is being done in the IR. So I've been showing you a lot of these spectra today. This is an optical spectrum of a fairly typical red supergiant. We are going to be working in the JWST and WFIRST era over here, in the near IR, let alone the mid IR, somewhere over in this regime. And red supergiants, frankly, like most stars, are a bit understudied in the IR regime. Our spectral type tools are in the optical, most of our ground-based telescopes are working in the optical, so we know them pretty well here, but still have a lot to develop if we really want to start studying these large scale in the IR. We can improve this in the JWST era if we survey massive stars like red supergiants in bands that are optimized for something like pre-explosion imaging and for things like determining temperatures and luminosities. But the first step is knowing which bands those are. So this is some research that I did last year on trying to study red supergiants with JWST. I wanted to start out in the simplest regime, so I was just looking at what photometry of red supergiants with James Webb would look like. So you can combine theoretical red supergiant spectra. These are the Phoenix stellar atmosphere models for red supergiants, which are actually optimized for looking at them right in this wavelength regime from about 0.8 to 2.5 microns. You can also look at actual observed red supergiant spectra in the near IR. So these are all IRTF spectra for now. That's the best tool that we have for the near IR spectra of red supergiants taken as part of John Rayner's Big Cool Stars catalog. So you can see a range, I'm now plotting them from warmest on the top to coldest on the bottom, of different red supergiants that we've got from 0.8 again to about 2.5 microns. Some of these spectra actually go almost out to 5 microns. And then finally, the last ingredient would be to combine these theoretical and observed spectra width throughput curves for JWST and the near-cam filter. So we have this hysterical extra-wide filter that's just going to give us all the near-infrared light from the star, along with some wide, medium, and then narrow-band filters. So from this, we can try and combine different filter colors with what we know about these stars' physical properties to see if we can pull out any useful diagnostics. And we actually do have a few. So what's plotted here is the color of our model red supergiants on the x-axis versus temperature on the y-axis. And this is the F070W, I've never figured out how to pronounce these, F070W James Webb filter minus another filter. So that could be 90, 115, 150, 200 as we go from blue to red. You can see that F070W minus F200W is actually not a bad gauge of temperature. The color changes fairly noticeably as we go from cold stars to warm stars. It's not super surprising because this is kind of similar to V minus K, which is a set of Johnson filters that have already worked pretty well as a color diagnostic for red supergiant temperature. Another good filter to use is F090W. This, again, can work pretty well as a temperature gauge. It also winds up being a great discriminator when you plot a color-color diagram between red supergiants and foreground dwarfs, which can be a really problematic contamination sample. If we don't have a great understanding of the foreground and background population, you can easily mistake a foreground M dwarf for a background red supergiant in a distant galaxy. If we plot 70 minus 90 on the x-axis and 90 minus 200 on the y-axis, you'll see that red supergiants follow this nice axis, and both solar metallicity and subsolar metallicity dwarfs follow a very different progression. What we're seeing are surface gravity and line blanketing effects between dwarfs and supergiants. The dominant source of continuum opacity in both red dwarfs and red supergiants is H-. It actually reaches a local minimum in the F200W wavelength regime. The higher densities in dwarfs wind up giving us a higher opacity in those stars, so that makes their continuum flux weaker in 200W and gives you this nice separation between dwarfs and red supergiants. So if you were to grab JWST observations of red supergiants in these three filters, you would have enough to measure temperature, you'd have enough to get rid of contaminating foreground dwarfs, and then finally we can calculate bolometric corrections for all of the JWST filters, and it turns out that the FO90W filter actually is great for estimating luminosities. The bolometric correction here is extremely small because that filter sits right near the peak of a red supergiant's SED, right around 9,000 angstroms. So you can do a comparison between what physical properties you infer for red supergiants with our well-tested optical methods versus these new near-IR methods. So these are data points for about 13 red supergiants in the Milky Way that we had great optical data for and John Rayner spectra of using IRTF. Right now, these are those stars' parameters using optical data. So the temperatures are based on the strengths of the titanium oxide bands in the optical, and bolometric corrections from the MARX stellar atmosphere models as they've been applied to K magnitudes. This is the exact same sample, but using near-IR properties. So now these are taking the Rayner spectra, converting them into simulated JWST photometry, getting temperatures in this case from FO90W minus F150W, so not even the best diagnostic possible, but the one we could use with the spectral coverage, and then the bolometric corrections based on the FO90W simulated filter and the Phoenix models. So there's literally nothing shared between these two sets of data points. You can connect them up by star, and with the open data points coming from optical data and the MARX models, and the closed data points coming from IR data and the Phoenix models, we have pretty decent agreement. In both cases, we're getting red supergiants that show good agreement with the predictions of stellar evolutionary tracks, and that land about where we would expect these stars to be when they're getting ready to die. So there's a lot more that we want to refine. We'd love to use the best possible colors to try and get temperature rather than just what we have from the data. But this now gives us a starting point when we start using JWST right on time in 2021, we know which filters to immediately begin imaging with so that we can start getting a good look at these stars and start inferring their physical properties. What we'd also love to do is move first to spectroscopy, but then to the mid-IR. So the mid-IR is ideal for identifying red supergiants. It's a great way to discern, for example, between red supergiants and giants, because at that point we're starting to probe circumstellar dust and the composition of the circumstellar dust. We can start quantifying mass loss in really useful ways. The problem is we really need more data for this. Working in the mid-IR, we have almost no options available to get spectra of red supergiants. So we have almost none. We don't have entirely no options, because SOFIA can observe in this wavelength regime. So I'm going to be heading down to New Zealand in less than a month to fly on SOFIA out of Christchurch, and it's going to be observing a bunch of Milky Way red supergiants with the forecast instrument, which will get spectra going from about 8 to 13 microns. All of the targets in this have already been observed in the optical. So we have beautiful optical spectra of them. We'll be getting 8 to 13 micron spectra. Some are already observed in John Rayner's catalog. Others we can get with either future IRTF time or other near IR observations. And what we'll wind up with is this sweet continuum image of a red supergiant from 4,000 angstroms all the way up to 13 microns. This will mean that we can compare evolutionary models and what we're inferring from the parameters that we get in different regimes. This means that we can test atmosphere models for these stars, and it means that we'll end up pretty well equipped to study these in the future when we start using something like James Webb or WFIRST. So on that note, I want to leave up a bunch of things that you can poke at with your phone. I've been mentioning a handful of papers by myself and my students looking at different aspects of either massive stellar evolution or red supergiant properties. I also want to point to the book that I wrote on red supergiants back in 2017. This was part of the AAAS IOP ebook series. This is free if you have an institutional ebook subscription. You can simply go to the IOP website and download it as a PDF or as an e-reader format. So this isn't a money plug. This is a please enjoy and learn reading about red supergiants because they're fascinating plug. So I will leave all of these up here, and I'm happy to answer whatever questions you have. Thank you.
Under his observations, I suppose the time scale for the variation that you're looking at is quite long. So these should be could be studied with a full frame images. And then you get all the stars in the STIS field.
You're talking about the STIS pre-image?
Tests.
Yeah. So the problem is that you really have to try targeting them. And I think that Sector 1 specifically had very few. Just simply didn't capture that many red supergiants in its initial observations. Yeah. So our Cycle 2 proposal is specifically trying to identify...
But you don't have to target them. You get everything. Mm-hmm. You get all the stars in the field. Mm-hmm. And you get time series for all the stars in the field. Mm-hmm. So the data are there. It's just a matter of
extracting it.
You don't have to target stars specifically. That's the problem.
Right. What we're trying to do is make sure that enough stars are covered in future test observations that we can keep doing this. And I mean, part of the proposal too was also getting the funding to support doing this. But yeah, hopefully we'll wind up with a huge bank of test observations of massive stars. And I mean, with massive stars, huge is always a relative term. We have a whopping sample of 135 when people are getting millions of stars out of something like TESS or Gaia or similar. But it'll still be a great sample to work with. We just need to get the data out.
Yeah, also, Gaia is also going to give you a lot of everything.
Yes.
On small, random sampling.
Yes. But it'll be some good extra data points to have, yes. Yeah.
Beautiful talking. I think one question I was trying to connect the binary studies of lower mass with the ones you're doing here. And at lower mass, we've kind of seen evidence that the binary fractions, kind of 10% of the giants do something interesting, 90% don't. And the other bit is there's a strong noticing dependence on the binary properties. And under your system, are more compact and swap binaries. So I guess my question is, can you say anything interesting? base and things like that. I'm trying to kind of see if we can have any information on interaction.
So there's a really interesting result that came out of Trevor's paper on stellar populations almost by accident that appears to show a trend with metallicity, that you get more binaries at higher metallicity. There are a heap of selection effects that need to be disentangled before we can say that for sure. We almost didn't put it in the paper because we're concerned about some of the speculative details, but there seems to be some evidence of a metallicity dependence. That is opposite from what people find in low mass, so that's one of the reasons we're skeptical. The actual binary fraction for high mass stars too, and how we translate that to an interacting binary fraction, and what we see as a binary fraction in O stars versus red supergiants versus Wolf-Rayet stars, is also still very much active. So we know that it's ridiculous to try and ignore binaries, and whether the observed fraction winds up at, like, early observations of O stars, we're putting it at 35%. When you then try to accommodate for completeness, that goes up anywhere from a little all the way to claims that all massive stars are in binaries. When you look at evolved massive stars, we need to understand how many have merged versus how many still haven't interacted versus how many specifically interacted in the red supergiant stage. So none of this is quantified yet, and I think that trying to quantify that is the first step before we then move on to modeling full populations of it. So we're trying to come at it from both a population standpoint and a kind of look at the stars one by one or close to one by one standpoint to see where we converge. Yeah. Yeah.
Which reminds me that red supergiants, like red giants, have long secondary periods. That is, periods that are much longer than their pulsation for reasons nobody understands.
Mm-hmm.
So in the case of supergiants, they're many years long.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if there could be a connection between the two.
It's undoubtedly coming from the same phenomenon. I think the one catch there is a lot of these stars, if you look at old catalogs, they're classified with this wonderful hand wave of semi-periodic. So I think that translates to probably has a period, but we can't tell. I know that Myra variables are also really interesting too, because they'll have these very long periods. George Wallerstein informed me about a week ago that the Myra classification was essentially random, that they basically decided if something has a magnitude variation of more than 2.5, we'll call it a Myra. If not, we call it something else. So I think that the same phenomenon has to be going on. We would love it to be pulsations, because that would be very easy and make a lot of sense, but the lack of being able to measure the periodicity really makes it difficult. Our best evidence for pulsations in some of these stars is actually not even the long-term variability. It's that in some of these stars, you'll see excited Balmer lines, similar to what you see in Myra's, from pulsational excitation kind of in the deep, slightly deeper layers in the atmosphere that we know will come from that mechanism, but actually quantifying the pulsations is still very much a mess. But because those are all coming from the fact that these are big, cool, puffy stars, the mechanisms are almost surely going to be at least related, if not the same. Yeah?
It would be really helpful if you would be able to say what the T effective of the high Auchi track is as a function of metallicity.
Yes.
Do you think, I mean, you sort of showed that in the N33 slices.
Mm-hmm. We have it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It sounds like.
So I don't.
The 10th solar, so twice or something?
Yep. I took off the actual numbers on these slides because I didn't want there to be too much going on, but we've slapped actual numbers on these. I don't. You can look them up in the paper, but it's something like 3650, 3750, and then 3800 or similar. But we do have actual numbers on them. Now, those are coming from the Geneva tracks, and we want to get an observation.
Right.
All
you get is stellar atmospheres. You're allowed to use stellar atmospheres, but
yes.
No stellar evolution.
Right. So we certainly could do something similar. What you need to really argue about is whether what you want is the average temperature of the red supergiants or the cold limit. Because to me, what you would want is to find the coldest stars in every environment. And if you can get the right color selection and make sure that you're not actually accidentally getting AGB stars, that's fairly straightforward to do. I think that we could do it, but I think we need a bigger data set than what we currently have, because what you want to be doing is guaranteeing you're getting the coldest star in every environment that you look at.
But what you showed in N33.
Yeah. These.
Looked.
Yeah.
You clearly got the derivative, but I guess I'm not asking about the absolute
value. I think Maria's paper might include what the mean temperatures are. So it won't necessarily tell you what the Hayashi limit is, but it'll quantify numerically how the temperatures are changing as the metallicity goes up. So yeah, at some point we should be able to do a Z goes as TF times X, or to the X relationship, and actually connect the two. Oh, that's math that I did for my NSF proposal and don't remember right now. But James Webb can go pretty far out. And I mean, James Webb does not have the beautiful field of view gain that W first would, so the gain is in individual stars. I know that I did this math through the TMT, and you can go out to 50 megaparsecs and get an individual star. Crowding starts to become the limiting factor long before brightness does, but if you could isolate an individual star, you could get way, way beyond the local group. You could get out past your local clusters.
For a type 2 B progenitor,
Yeah, so that would put you around, where did it go? Where'd it go? Right around here. So you can get 50, you can grab, say, 50, a 15 solar mass star and try to figure out exactly how far away it would be. But we should be able to go out to very good distances, and it's largely thanks to the fact that their SEDs are so nicely positioned to be bright in the IR.
No, I mean, that's really important, because it gives you a representative volume of the universe for the first time.
Yeah. We would for sure be able to get at things like any red supergiant population in OneSwiki 18, where there should, in theory, be plenty of these. So, yeah.